Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, September 12, 2009. I'm Harley Schlanger. I will be your host. This week, President Obama went before a joint session of Congress and the American people, and he lied, just as Lyndon LaRouche had warned him not to do. The president demonstrated his dysfunctional mental capabilities when he stated that it's wrong to say that his bill promotes euthanasia, that is, the killing off of the elderly and the very ill. And then he went on to describe exactly how this is what he intends to do, by slashing payments for medical care under an independent advisory board in order to continue to bail out the bankrupt banks and financial institutions. The day after this lying speech, my colleague, historian Anton Chaitkin, provided documentation which proves that not only is the president pushing policies modeled on those adopted by Nazi Führer Adolf Hitler, policies which were condemned at Nuremberg in the war trials as the beginnings of the mass murder policy of the Nazis, but that the president's policies are promoted directly by the British monarchy, and in particular are implemented under the direction of networks loyal to Tony Blair. Later in the program, we'll be joined by LaRouche Youth Movement member Jason Ross, who will tell us about his highly successful participation in an international conference in Prague, commemorating the work of the great scientist Johannes Kepler. But we'll begin with Tony Chaitkin. Tony, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Harley.
Now, earlier this week, we were looking into the so-called Liverpool Care Pathway, which is a protocol which has been adopted by the National Health Service in Britain and is now responsible for one out of every six deaths in Great Britain. They've adopted a policy which, once they determine that death is coming or is the likely outcome, a patient is denied food and water and then heavily sedated until they die. Tell our listeners what you discovered about this imposition of the same policies which were adopted by the Nazis under the T4 death policy. What did you learn when you looked into where this came from?
We heard from the news media in Britain that there was a protest by doctors against this Liverpool Care pathway, which was killing people, one out of six every people that died in England last year. And so looking behind this, I found out that the British government adopted this as a universal program in 2008. And this was developed as an experiment by the Marie Curie Hospice Organization in the Marie Curie Palliative Care Institute in Liverpool. They were doing an experimental killing program that was started up in 2003 and 2004 under the Tony Blair regime by him and Simon Stevens, his healthcare reform advisor.
Now, Tony, I just want to make a point to our listeners who hear a lot, especially if they're involved with older parents or themselves are in various kinds of treatments. The original idea for palliative care was the use of new technologies that can lessen pain. But
right.
What it's become recently is the idea of easing death, euthanasia. So they've used
yes.
a word that had an honorable meaning for doctors initially, and they've turned it into its opposite, namely the prelude to death.
That's right. It's always been somewhat ambiguous, but there are a lot of compassionate people involved in hospices and so forth. This is not assisted suicide. It isn't suicide at all. It is involuntary euthanasia. The protests were about from families of people whose loved ones were murdered in this program. So what happened is that when the crash came in the financial bubble in 2007, the City of London financiers and the royal family went into high gear to make this euthanasia program a national policy, to transfer huge sums out of healthcare and other things that, like social welfare and jobs and anything else, into saving these bankrupt financiers. This thing was done under the leadership of the royal family directly. There's a group in England, what they call a think tank of the royal family. Its name is the King's Fund, K-I-N-G apostrophe S, Fund.
And you found out this goes way back.
Yes, this fund was set up by Prince Edward, Prince of Wales, in the late 19th century. When he became King Edward VII, this organization for the reform of medicine was incorporated as the King Edward's Hospital Fund for London. That was the official name. And King Edward and his friends were deeply involved in the what were really the fascist movements of the late 19th and early 20th century, centering on eugenics and race purification for the empire. This fund continued all throughout the 20th century. And it was associated early on with the Fabians as well, and in the post-World War II period. What happened is that last year, 2008, after the crash, the fund was commissioned with a new incorporation by Queen Elizabeth. It was renamed simply the King's Fund, and Prince Charles, who had been the head of it since 1986, was given the go-ahead to organize the euthanasia program for England and the British, the United Kingdom. He is also he's the president of that King's Fund. He is the president also of this killing research organization, the Marie Curie Hospice.
Tony, let me ask you a question on this, because a lot of our listeners have this idea of the monarchy that they're basically for show. It's part of entertainment for the English people. To what extent does Prince Charles actually have hands-on control over an organization such as this?
Well, you can answer that question by the story that I'm talking about, and that's what I want to go through. I'll go through his role. What do they do? He works directly with leading international financiers. There's a guy named Tom Hughes Hallett, who was a banker from Robert Fleming and J. Henry Schroeder Banks. He's a 22-year City of London financier. He is the chief executive of the Marie Curie Hospice, and he is also a senior advisor to Prince Charles through this fund. So Charles and his immediate circle, including Simon Stevens, works closely with the City of London financiers and as a team with the royal family leading the way in certain themes, such as euthanasia, such as population reduction. They accomplish this. And here's what they did. They set up a national task force through the National Health Service of the United Kingdom, a task force to get the euthanasia going. And the head of that, the chairman for implementation of that strategy board for the euthanasia is this guy, Tom Hughes Hallett. And in 2008, they extended this experimental killing program from the Liverpool center where they had been trying this out into places all over the United Kingdom. They're also trying to spread it to other countries. The way this works is the first step, as the National Health Service came out with a report on how they're doing this, which I read. And the first step is trying to choose the people who are to be killed. You try to find those who show some weakness, signs of confusion, coupled with age, coupled with some medical condition, where you could credibly show that statistically they're likely to die. And then if you get them in a hospital, one way or another, or they're already in a hospital, Then you put them on morphine or stronger drugs so that they go into the equivalent of a coma and immediately remove nutrition and hydration so that they die very, very quickly. The next step, and the Liverpool care pathway is what they call this method of killing. That is the step five, which is death. And then step six, published by the National Health Service for this euthanasia drive, step six is how to dispose of the bodies, how to dispose of the families, what to do with the families who might get in your hair, and a recommendation in print to change the rules for death certificates so that it doesn't appear that the people were killed.
But, Tony, this is now documented that one out of six deaths in Great Britain is through this Livermore care or Liverpool care pathway.
Yes, a study by Dr. Clive Seal of Barts and the London School of Medicine and Dentistry did a thorough study of this program. And this was cited in the letters to the Daily Telegraph by these protesting physicians.
So this is not hypothetical in the least.
Right, this is now.
This is actually being implemented right now. Now, what is the connection then with Simon Stevens and the Obama side of it?
This may be the most explosive thing that I'm going to report. Simon Stevens implemented the pilot project at Liverpool for Tony Blair in 2003-2004. When he was the advisor, and he is in the Prince Charles organization himself as a trustee of the King's Fund. When Tony Blair resigned in 2007, Simon Stevens left Britain, came to the United States, became a vice president of the largest HMO in the United States, United Health, with 70 million victims or customers. And he was put in charge of the health reform initiative of the entire private health insurance industry as the designated man to work with the Obama administration to put through this euthanasia program. Possibly even more explosive, Simon Stevens runs the health insurance for the American Association of Retired Persons, AARP.
Huh.
If you want to stay alive, I'd suggest you stay out of AARP and change our government, because otherwise you're going to be killed.
Wow. That
they got this British Nazi over here organizing our government and agencies like AARP to murder Americans.
Now you're listening to Tony Chaitkin, who has published a short piece that's up on the LaRouche Pack website titled "The British Monarchy Caught in a Death Scheme." And there's also with this a comment from Lyndon LaRouche calling attention to this article. LaRouche's piece is called "The British Monarchy and Hitler Today." So, Tony, I have one more question for you.
Yeah.
That I think is important. In your piece, you write that this has been since Edward VII, the planning center for the reform of healthcare, which, in accord with the empire's innovation of the time, included eugenics and race purification theory. The president has been furious with Lyndon LaRouche's charge that he's implementing Hitler policies. Of course, many people who oppose the healthcare so-called healthcare reform, and who are out in the street, have rallied around the LaRouche Pack poster of Obama with the toothbrush Hitler mustache, and this has gotten the administration completely up in arms. But what this report does is to make not just the connections, the intellectual connections, but the actual personnel connections to a policy of mass genocide. It seems to me, then, that this does represent the potential to put the nail in the coffin of this so-called health reform policy.
Yes, and of the British Empire behind it. Recall that in the 1930s, when the British created the so-called voluntary euthanasia movement in England, and they spread that to the United States, they were trying to boost Hitler's ability to do euthanasia over in Germany. In that year, they euthanized King George the Fifth, and in his place came in Edward the Eighth, a more or less openly pro-Nazi fellow. And at this time, you had this raging group of fascists, open fascists in New York and London, financial centers, including especially the governor of the Bank of England, Montague Norman, cooperating with the British monarchy for fascism and Nazism in the world. And the real question here today is not the euthanasia as something that continues, but rather this gang itself, the British monarchy, the City of London, and their stooges in Wall Street, that have given us various types of nightmare, dark ages movements, including fascism. And it is their representatives in around Obama, such as these Nazi economists, Larry Summers, Peter Orszag, and the Emanuel brothers, and so forth. These people represent that London-New York axis that has given the world the great tragedy of the last two centuries. That's what's got to be finished off.
And Tony, I think one of the things they counted on was the pessimism in the American people that's come out of the Bush administration, the Bush-Cheney regime, the endless wars, the collapse of jobs and foreclosures and so on, to play on this idea in people that, look, once you've lived your life, you're sick, we can't afford it anymore, why don't you just go off and die? And yet what appears to be the case is that there has been a dramatic response from the American people who are basically saying, we are the people and it's our constitutional right to be defended.
I was in Washington. There's about 1.5 million people in the streets in Washington today. And the media is characterizing this as tens of thousands of right-wingers. And this is totally crazy because these people are exactly as you say. They are Americans who are they were not crazy. They were happy people because they saw themselves with others saying, we are the people. We are not going to be destroyed by the gangsters who have taken control of our country and our government, and we want something better. There was a tremendous receptivity to LaRouche and to our literature.
Two weeks ago, I had Deborah Freeman on, and she reported that the people in Washington were completely caught off guard by this reaction. And I think we saw that in a comment from House Minority Leader John Boehner, who said that he was shocked at the kind of outpouring and the anger in the population. And yet, we're also seeing, as you're reporting, that people are looking for leadership. Some of the Tea Party websites have posted material from LaRouche PAC TV. So your sense was that people there are looking for an alternative, and it's not just a hate fest against Obama.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of very clever signs and people posing paradoxes. I saw one poster that had Obama dressed in a medieval suit, and it was Leviathan. It was a whole picture of Thomas Hobbes' book with Obama's head at the top of it. A lot of things attacking the Federal Reserve, people talking very widely about the destruction of the economy, everybody saying fire the Congress. The Congress is much more the target of hatred, I would say. People are fed up with Obama and hate what he's doing, but the real visceral anger comes out at both the Congress and the news media.
Well, I think, Tony, this piece that you've written provides an extra bit of evidence that if people were still scratching their heads, they now can see that this is, in fact, the policy. Now, just one quick final question. I want to see if Jason might have a question for you, but the role of Tony Blair, this is something that a lot of Americans haven't understood, but Blair was there side by side with Clinton at the end of the Clinton administration. He was pushing the deregulation and the globalization policies, side by side with Bush and Cheney creating phony reports of weapons of mass destruction and pushing for global support for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And now here he is again while he's auditioning for the role of dictator of the world. It's his health care policies that are killing people in Britain and that are part of the Obama policy. So I presume that we will continue to focus it at EIR and EIW on the role of Blair until this guy gets his richly deserved early retirement.
Yeah, this is a very sinister figure, a so-called liberal imperialist going around on yachts with his billionaire friends. And he is, his whole regime was these Fabian killers. Works with a group that really it was instituted, I would say, at the end of World War II by people like Max Morrison and Julian Huxley. They started things like the IUCN, the World Wildlife Fund, and so forth. Remember that when Thatcher privatized things, she had some early wars and so forth, but she could never have gotten away with what Blair did as a so-called liberal imperialist. He further privatized the health service.
Tony, isn't that the model for Obama, that you couldn't get Bush or Cheney to take
away
Social Security and Medicare, but you can get an African-American so-called progressive to do it?
And that's more or less exactly what the Fabian Society has been stating. They published right after the Obama election, and then a couple of months later, I think in March, they put out a book, a report and then a book, on what they have done. They have done getting Obama in and what they hope to get out of it. And that's precisely the point, is that they did this with Blair, and Blair was on board for Bush, and now becomes the British friend of Obama, even though Blair is no longer the prime minister.
Well, Tony, thank you very much for joining us and for rushing back to the studio and for doing this kind of work. Jason, before Tony goes, did you have a question for him? I wonder if we've lost Jason. Jason, you there?
Is he in Washington?
No. George, do you have any indication that Jason's still with us?
I think I do, but I don't hear him. Jason, if you can hear me, say something. Uh-oh. We got something in his face.
It's a sea of humanity there, so if anybody's there, there may be complications, but it was a lot of fun. It was very exciting.
Well, Tony, until we get Jason, I'm going to keep you on the line. Tell us a little bit more. This was broadly sponsored by the so-called 9/12 group, the Tea Party, but my sense from what I've seen around the country, and I've been on a number of the conference calls with them and also with Ron Paul groups, the old Puma groups, there seems to be a coalescing of people who might be, in the past, some of them would be considered moderates. You're even getting some of the progressives who are not yet joining, but who are angry about the Afghan war. They're angry about Obama's alliance with the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical interests. How would you characterize the people who were there?
Well, remember that the Tea Party itself really was, I think, started up a while ago as a tax protest and similar things by bank financiers associated with the Mont Pelerin Society and their groups. And in this year, in 2009, the character of the movement associated with it veered off entirely from that, so that at some of the rallies you would see certain people representing that old initiating force making the stupid statements like, we don't like Obama, and then saying we need to implement some kind of euthanasia. And the crowd booing them because that's not what they're about.
Well, Tony, one of the dividing lines I saw was that people were initially saying, we don't like Obama because he's a socialist. And what started to happen is a number of these people involved began to figure out that this isn't socialism, this is corporatism, this
yes.
is fascism.
Yeah. I think that what you see there is everybody that has an idea from anything in their past or anything that they've learned of the enemy, namely the Wall Street and what they understand about that, having power and having a government that doesn't represent the population. I can say for sure that the mass of the people that were out there today do not have some program for saving the country, and they want to save the country. So that's where LaRouche comes in. Without LaRouche, this thing could be quite, it would be a disaster. But I think you should go back to the original Tea Party for information. According to the British and Harvard, all that was a tax protest. And that's the way some of the people are going to portray this, as a bunch of right-wing tax protesters, where in fact you had the character of every real change in history, and especially within the United States, that was led by people who believed in a republic, like Henry Clay, like Lincoln, like other people, and in the American Revolution, you always had a very ambiguous program or policy outlook in the minds of the people that was then shaped by progressive leaders who had some idea about how to save mankind and save our country, like Henry Clay bringing in the War Hawks 200 years ago today. They elected into Congress in 1810 of people that were not professional politicians to force the government to fight the British.
And that was necessary to save the country.
And they had a nationalist program, and Clay was a Jeffersonian. And this was done from within the Jefferson Party.
Yep.
And they brought in Hamilton Economics.
I think I heard Jason get on, is that right?
Yeah, hello.
Hi, Jason. Okay, we must have lost you for a couple of minutes. So, Tony, thank you very much for joining us today and giving us this report. Everyone should go to the LaRouche PAC website and read the article from Tony Chaikin, The British Monarchy Caught in a Death Scheme, as well as Lyndon LaRouche's comments on it. Reproduce it. Get it out. For those friends of yours who are influenced by the lying president who says that we don't have a death panel, we're not going to kill grandma, bring this to those people and say, you read this, you study this, now you tell me what it looks like. If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck and does everything else like a duck, Mr. President, you're a liar. So I think, Tony, good work on this, and we'll have you on again soon.
Thanks, Harley.
Okay. Now, Jason, before we take up the discussion with you, I just want to answer a question that came in via email. And if people have questions either for what Tony covered or what Jason's about to cover, you can send them to us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio, R-A-D-I-O, at LaRouchePub, LaRouchePub.com. There's a question from a friend of mine from the Bay Area who asks in a fairly frustrated tone, where is the institution of the presidency? Obama is becoming more insane by the hour. Where are the people who are part of this institution of the presidency? Well, Brian, let me tell you, there are two points here. One, Tony was answering part of your question, that as we see the explosion of activity in the streets, the new marchers who are coming out, the housewives, the unemployed workers, the seniors who are beginning to sense they're going to lose everything, we're getting a movement in the population which will both frighten those politicians who are adhering to this British death policy, but also maybe encourage and give some backbone to those who should be defending the nation. Now, the other point is that Lyndon LaRouche addressed precisely those people in his webcast last Tuesday. On his 87th birthday, September the 8th, and by the way, I was just on a radio show, and the talk show host said, LaRouche is like a young kid overturning everything in sight. And so, if people go to the website and watch Lynn's webcast, you'll get a very clear picture of Lyndon LaRouche addressing the institution of the presidency and saying to them, you can't wait, you have to step up now. And he said to the president, Mr. President, we'll defend you and protect you. We'll keep you protected in the Oval Office and give you a program that will work, but you've got to get rid of Orszag, Summers, the Emanuel brothers, Geithner. Get rid of this crew that's functioning on behalf of these British Nazis. And so whether they respond or not will probably depend on how much they study the ideas of LaRouche and get it, and at the same time are prodded by this movement. Now we're going to shift gears a little bit here. Joining me now is Jason Ross. Jason is a leader of the LaRouche Youth Movement. He was part of the, I think, one of the original basement teams that did an extensive bit of work on Johannes Kepler and put up some material on the website, which was quite startlingly original, including animations. Jason was recently invited to participate in a major international conference in Prague in the Czech Republic, which was commemorating the release 400 years ago of one of Johannes Kepler's great works, the Astronomia Nova. So, Jason, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Thanks, Arlie.
Tell us a little bit about this conference, what went on there, and what you presented.
Well, it was as you said, it was a conference to commemorate the 400th anniversary of Kepler's first really major work. And the theme of the conference was Kepler's heritage in the space era. There were people from about 12 different countries there. There were about two dozen presentations, I think 60 registered participants. And for the most part, people gave presentations on aspects of Kepler's life or his relationship to Galileo, why Galileo was such a jerk, or his relationship with Tycho Brahe. There were a few presentations on the new astronomy, including myself. There were four of us that actually spoke about the book that the conference was commemorating.
Jason, let me ask you, did you actually have people talking about the superiority of Kepler to Galileo? Because most modern science denigrates Kepler in favor of Galileo.
No, it's true. I actually, one of the participants at the conference is the head of the Kepler Working Group for the International Astronomical Union, and he was pretty irritated that this is the year of astronomy, it's 2009, and that Galileo is being celebrated when he didn't do anything in 1609 besides receive a telescope in the mail, whereas Kepler discovered the motions of the planets.
All right, so you mean some of these guys actually do understand real science?
Well, some of them have a certain respect for Kepler, although what I found was that people were not very thoroughly read on Kepler's books. I mean, one man I had met who seemed like he was an interested guy, I had asked him, so have you worked through the new astronomy? And he said, oh, no, I'm an astronomer. Meaning, he's not a historian, so why bother, what could we learn from a genius in the past for today's problems?
Well, now, you were with the basement team that did the work on the new astronomy originally, I think, right?
Yep, 3 years ago.
So what is in the new astronomy that was worthy of a celebration 400 years after its release?
Well, it was a big attack on Aristotle and Euclid, which is always worth celebrating. This is a book, it's known today, if you went on Wikipedia, shame on you, but you would find out that the new astronomy is where Kepler put forward what are called his first two laws, which is that a planet moves in an ellipse around the sun, and that its motion traces out equal areas in equal times. Now, those were the results that Kepler came to in the new astronomy from a hypothesis that he had had years before, that instead of looking for geometry and mathematics as a way to understand reality, you've got to look at physics. You've got to have a creative idea of what's causing the things that we observe. And so, unlike Copernicus, who put the sun in the center in as much as the planets went around it, Kepler looked at the sun as the cause of the motion of the planets. And that enabled him to break beyond the bounds of mathematics and move into physics.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is in the new astronomy. Now, there's quite a bit in the new astronomy. I mean, Kepler actually takes you through his developing hypotheses, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's very, it's really wonderful in that respect. I mean, it's sort of, it's the beginning of modern science. So it's an incredibly, what he discovered was incredibly powerful. It was the beginning of science. And he was kind enough to write down for you what his thinking process was in a way that organizes the reader. Because you could sort of have the right answer. I mean, Kepler could have just printed his tables of where the planets would be, and everyone would have said, wow, this guy's a genius. He knows how, you know, he made a perfect table. But he went through, how did he get there? What were some of the problems he came across along the way? How could he... Well, one of the most important things that he did was, in the same way that when Socrates has discussions with people in the dialogues that Plato wrote, it's rare for Socrates to tell somebody, no, you're wrong, you're an idiot. This is the way it works. Instead, he lets them disagree with themselves by drawing out more of their thoughts and then seeing how they contradict themselves, which really forces his interlocutors to think. Kepler does the same thing. He takes two assumptions that everybody was making, that planets move in circles and that there is some imaginary point around which the planet moves constantly, almost like there's a lighthouse somewhere and the planet always has to be in the beam coming from the rotating lighthouse. And with those two assumptions, Kepler went as far as he could, did the best study ever with those assumptions, and it still had an unavoidable error, which meant that those assumptions were wrong. And so it makes people have to be open to looking beyond geometry then and take his approach and look at physics, look at cause.
And what did you present in your paper at this conference?
Well, before I'd gotten there, I was planning on going through the website that we had put together on WLYM.com somewhat briefly.
That website is still the... that's still up and available for people. Tell them where to find it.
Yeah, WLYM.com. You can also find it on LaRouchePack.com. There's a link on the right for the Basement Project, and then you can click on the New Astronomy from there.
Okay, so that's what you were planning to present when you first got there.
I planned to go through it briefly, more to focus on how we had used animations to do something that's never been done before, which is teaching on a mass scale how Kepler made his discovery. It's a book that's sort of been read by, you know, a few experts here and there or astronomers, but it's never been a general part of education, and it should be. And in the LaRouche youth movement, it is. So I had planned to go through the website briefly and then focus mostly on Mr. LaRouche, his economic success, his economic method, read some of the quotes from the paper where he set us off on the mission on really working through the new astronomy. And since the conference was themed Kepler's Heritage in the Space Era, and as listeners hopefully will have checked out on the LaRouche Pack website, we just put up a movie about going from the moon to Mars.
And we just had that as the topic on the LaRouche show last week, where we had your colleagues, Ouyang and Peter, on as guests.
Exactly, yes. And so that's what I plan to conclude with that, with going through space colonization. That would be a good way to celebrate the birthday of Kepler's work would be to go to Mars in person to make observations, which Kepler didn't do.
What happened that caused you to change your plans?
Well, a couple things. One is I met a very devout mathematician from Britain. She's sort of one of the big new astronomy experts in the world. And she was there, she gave a presentation where I guess it's the trouble of being both British and a mathematician, is that her refrain as she was going through Kepler's work was that he never used cause, he didn't use physics, there was no sense of dynamics, and that Kepler discovered the ellipse using mathematics. Which is just totally, it's something that Kepler would have, you know, grabbed her if he was there, and, you know, or at least would have disagreed. But she was really sort of tormenting everybody at the conference by being very adamant with this position, including in her questions to other people and discussion periods and things like that. And I decided it would probably make sense to actually go through the New Astronomy for people, realizing that they didn't really know much about the book. So I went through what I just described with you about the impossibility of the planet's orbit being circular or having uniform motion, and using the animations on the website along the way to demonstrate what I thought was a sort of a quick summary of how Kepler came up with elliptical motion in the proper fashion. And then I showed some pictures from some of our youth conferences. They were pretty amazed to see a photograph from one of our California youth conferences of 100 people working on this book. They're used to only, I don't know, people with 3 PhDs ever reading it.
But it's from what you're saying now, to go back to this British mathematician, mm-hmm. she was essentially denying the method that Kepler used in this book that was being honored at this conference.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I thought she really had some gall to come to Prague and do that to Kepler, and I didn't want to let her get away with it.
So you had a bit of a dialogue with her.
You could say that. It was mostly civil. Well, because, I went through what Kepler actually did in my presentation. I knew it was going to certainly upset her, and it did. So that after I was done, there were a couple of questions about details on the New Astronomy or about LaRouche and our movement and about the space program. But she had this, like, incredibly specific mathematical question. And it's hard to... It's the sort of thing, it's like, it's good to have really been there to hear her voice and everything. But she was just screaming at me from the audience about whether I would admit publicly that I was wrong if she proved it to me with some equations. And she was just... It's the sort of thing that might have scared you if it wasn't just so absurdly funny. A lot of people afterwards thanked me, saying, "Oh, I'm glad you stood up to that woman. I was just scared of her when she asked me questions."
Well, Jason, let me, just for our listeners, because, first of all, this is not an esoteric debate. This gets right to the heart of the axiomatically revolutionary method that Lyndon LaRouche is bringing to the science of economics, which is mm-hmm. that you can never go with sense certainty, and you must never start with mathematics in approaching a question of science or economics. So this is not just something that's a debate that's over a 400-year-old text, but I think it's important to give our listeners a sense of what your background is, or what you did, rather, with the basement team that gave you a certain amount of expertise to participate in this conference. So tell them a little bit about the work that was done back in those early days of the youth movement on Kepler.
Well, and then even before, too, because, like Kepler, LaRouche is kind enough not just to be correct, but also to write papers and to communicate to people how he thinks so that people can replicate his method of thinking. And he is completely firm that you can't be a competent economist if you don't know, if you don't understand science and if you don't understand classical culture. Because it's human creativity, as you see in culture, and not in mathematics, which you should see in science, that's the key to human economic development. We don't move forward over the generations because we developed a better form of stock market, but because we developed breakthroughs in medicine, new forms of power, nuclear energy, the space program, etc. So the team I was with about 3 years ago in 2006, we were assembled working with LaRouche up in Northern Virginia. And we thought that we were going to be working on an economic program of transportation in the United States. And he sort of surprised us by saying, no. What we need to do, we need to create for people, what we need to animate economically is how Kepler made his discoveries. So we're going to start with the New Astronomy, and that's your task. Go to it. Show how a creative mind works. And so that initial project was followed by another group that worked through Kepler's Harmonies of the World, where he really lays out his universal principle of gravitation. Then by continuing work on Gauss, Riemann, and you're seeing that the results of that now with the interview last week and the video on Mars and space colonization.
So were people put off by the idea that, given that the topic of this was Kepler's heritage in the space era, clearly there's an intent in, I think, 10 or 12 nations to launch major aggressive exploration of space. And unfortunately, in the United States, under the effects of Bush, Cheney, and now Obama, there's a retrenchment in NASA, which will, I guess, be taken up by the Congress over the next couple of weeks. But were people intrigued by the idea that Kepler was at the heart of the political fight that the LaRouche movement is waging internationally?
Well, I don't think people knew what to think. Because, you know, I was the only, everyone else there worked at a university. And I actually began my presentation saying, I work for a political movement. This is not, I'm not a full-time astronomer, and I'm not a mathematician. I'm a political organizer. I mean, but we did. So, I mean, plus, I was the only one who talked about Kepler's heritage in the space era, just very directly. So people were very excited, both by the website, which, you know, people were pretty happy to see a guide to the book, which is an intimidating book, or it can
so
be.
So you actually had people sit around you at a computer, and you showed them what the website did look like and what they could find on it.
Yeah, well, I showed, you know, during the presentation, you had the overhead projector and the, you know, so I was using the website during my presentation. I also got out about, in Prague, in total, about 100 copies of the LaRouche Pack video at the Harvard Yard, which gives a summary of the work that the LaRouche Youth Movement has done on Kepler, the new astronomy, and the harmonies of the world, as well as an attack which was launched against us by a competitor website. So there was a lot of those things. People were really snatching those up, or multiple copies, right after the presentation.
And how did things end up with you and your new British friend?
Well, we sort of had the showdown. The last night of the conference, we had dinner on a boat that was, you know, on the river. And I didn't really want to do it, but eventually I was like, okay, you know, so we sat down, going through the equations. She was, you know, very... Anyway, I went through my calculation about... Not to be too technical, but she said that Kepler discovered the ellipse not because it worked better than another orbit, but because it was mathematically more beautiful to him. But Kepler in his book says that, in addition to that, it actually put the planet in the right place, and so the orbit didn't. And I said, you know, it's right here. Kepler has the calculation. I just did it this afternoon. I got the same number. She said, well, you obviously did it wrong. It's actually funny. She asked me if I had ever heard of this Professor Whiteside. And I said, no, I haven't. And she said, oh, people bow when they hear his name.
Well, we know they do a lot of bowing in the British Empire.
Yeah. Yeah, they can stick with the bowing.
Yeah.
Anyway, we had our duel, you know, we went through the things, which she said just it really didn't make sense. And part of it did, but it wasn't really relevant to Kepler. I mean, this is the sort of thing where you have a mathematician, where they might have, you know, one tiny point where they thought of something that Kepler hadn't thought of, but meanwhile, put in his shoes, would never have discovered anything. You don't get discoveries from mathematics. You don't find creativity in mathematics. And so she... You know, it's just sort of the gaping hole was that she missed cause. Kepler includes cause in the title of his book, The New Astronomy. She said that he didn't use it. So people asked afterwards who won. It was
Jason, I assume sort of that fun. Some of the contacts you made, you'll send them the new piece by Lyndon LaRouche on the science of economics so they can pick up where you left off with your presentation.
Yeah, I mean, because there is a number, in addition to the directly, you know, astronomical discussion, a lot of people said, okay, we can talk about Kepler later. Tell me more about your political movement. What are you guys doing? And so there was a lot of interest in the, I mean, it's a pretty phenomenal movement. It's completely unique in the world to have a political movement that knows what to do and that is developing the minds of leadership through study of science and classical composition. So... It was pretty fun. I sent out the space movie to everybody who was at the conference. I've received a few replies so far. People were happy to see it.
Did you send one to your British friend?
Of course. I also the, with the the second day of the conference, they had the grand opening of the Kepler Museum in Prague.
Ah.
It's actually the original house that he lived in when he wrote, when he completed writing the Astronomia Nova. And I was very sorry to see there that they had used the some animations made by Kepler'sDiscovery.com, which is the website that totally stole all of the work that we did. They did such a bad job doing it that they basically screwed up everything that they stole. So the Kepler Museum in Prague had these just terrible animations that were just totally wrong. And that was one thing that my British mathematician friend and I agreed on, which is that she said, "You're right, these are rubbish." I emailed the director of the museum the right animations to put up, so he said he's going to replace them. He's sorry
for
the confusion.
That's good. Well, this is the level of warfare that we're waging in the world right now, because the question of truth has to be at the center of science and the center of governing. And this is again, we go back to Socrates on this, that it's seeking truth rather than acceptance from those in power. And, of mm-hmm. course, you have in science now the domination of the same kind of ideas that Kepler was fighting, the Aristotelian, Euclidean approach to physical space-time. And it's as though the work that was done by Kepler and then Leibniz and then through Gauss and Riemann and Einstein and Vernadsky, as though this is all very interesting, but we have to keep our profession in shape.
Yeah, you can really see the use of authority. It's about you become a supposed authority not by being right, but by being just so incredibly mean to everybody else that they give up fighting you. That's sort of what I saw with this woman. And also, it seems like, not to put too much emphasis on her per se, but you get it with British foreign policy today. They'll stab you in the back. They know that you saw them, and then they say, "Oh, we didn't do that."
They'll say you're paranoid.
Yeah, right. That was ridiculous.
Well, now, Jason, the final question I have is I think, an important one, which is what you did see, though, is response to LaRouche's method of approach to science from most of the people who were there attending the conference with you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. People have come to think that it's just not possible to go through and really understand science from the inside. So I think it was probably very inspiring to them to see, you know, it probably almost seemed like it was my hobby and not, you know, I'm not a professor or anything. But I think it was inspiring for them to see that, look, here's a, you know, concerted work towards getting at the inside of science in a mass way. And one of the challenges I laid out to them was going to Mars and that the new astronomy should be taught in every high school in the world, which most of these professional astronomers haven't even read the book. I think they thought it was kind of a tall order. But I think the possibility of doing that is there, and people were pretty excited about really getting into these things and definitely about going to Mars.
And from your experience with the work on the new astronomy, you don't need to be a mathematician to get what Kepler is talking about.
No, not at all. I mean, you really could. You could do it in high school right now. All you need is, there's no calculus in it. There's no, he wrote it before most of the things that they torture mathematicians with even existed. The book was published in 1609, so there really wasn't that much mathematics around. Yeah, geometry, you had some, in fact, the real developments in mathematics as a language, such as Leibniz's development of the differential calculus, the infinitesimal calculus, came as a result of Kepler's prodding. He had a physical problem that couldn't be solved with mathematics as it was, and it required developing the language. And that's a legitimate use of mathematics. The way it's looked at today, it's like grammarians talking about words, but not actually talking about any real things in the world.
Well, Lyndon LaRouche said in a discussion with some of his associates the other day that people who think they need to have a definitive answer think they can get it only from mathematics. And they're
mm-hmm.
afraid of acknowledging that there are more questions that still have to be asked before you go and get a definitive answer.
Right. No, any answer to something new can't be expressed in the terms that already exist. That's why you need, this is why, you know, LaRouche stresses Percy Shelley and the and his defense of poetry, that it's the poets, it's people who bring in new abilities for thought. That drives, they're the legislators of mankind. That moves you forward, and you see it in the language of mathematics, where any solution to something new, you can't say it in the old words. If it's something new, it's something new. And so you get with, you know, this whole Bertrand Russell kind of tradition, this math, just being a mathematician, you kill creativity. I mean, you can't be a really intense mathematician and be creative.
Well, I think the mortality rate of mathematicians, the level at which, or the point at which creativity ends and psychosis begins, it's well documented, is sometime between 25 and 30, right after they finish the PhD.
Yeah, LaRouche said in a paper of his, the pagan worship of Isaac Newton, that the most fundamental emotion of all mathematicians is rage. I definitely saw that at the conference.
Well, Jason, this was an important conference for you to participate, and it actually points to one thing that we've been talking about quite a bit on the LaRouche show in recent months, which is that in this crisis, this devastating crisis of civilization, people are beginning to realize that the old ideas no longer work and that you have to be axiomatically revolutionary. And I presume this is probably the most important thing you take from this conference, that the best of the old ideas still work, but it's the principles behind them as opposed to the specifics, and that this is the challenge for science today.
Absolutely, absolutely. We'd like to focus on the question of creativity per se more in the upcoming videos that the basement produces on space.
Well, Jason, I'd like to thank you for joining us this afternoon, and I'll just close by telling our listeners that the material is available on Kepler on the WLYM.com website. And where do they find it on that website, Jason?
It'll be staring them in the face. There'll be links right on the front for the harmonies of the world.
Okay, and then on the LaRouche Pack website, you'll find, in addition to what we discussed in the first half of the program, the breaking scandal, the definitive evidence that President Obama's health care policy is the same as that imposed by Hitler and the Nazis, because its source is the same, the British monarchy, the Anglo-Dutch Saudi financial empire. On that same website that you find Tony's writing on this, you'll also find the beautiful documentary or film on the Moon-Mars mission, and there's more coming out, more expected. Do you know exactly what's being worked on, Jason?
Well, you know, pretty much every week we're going to have something coming out, a discussion, a new movie, so just keep posted, and we're going to have regular updates to it. I know at the moment the group that had worked through how Gauss determined the orbit of Ceres is pulling together a movie based on some of their further thoughts after having worked on it, on the role of the physical tensor and relativistic travel and Gauss determining the orbit of Ceres. I'm not involved in that exactly, but it looks like it'll be very exciting.
I also had a chance to see some of the photos you took of Prague, and it looked like it was quite a wonderful trip. So, Jason, thanks for joining us today. You've been listening to The LaRouche Show. We are live every Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern on LaRouchePub.com. And be sure to go to LaRouchePack.com for everything we've talked about. But also, if you haven't seen it yet, you can see the historic September 8th webcast on Lyndon LaRouche's 87th birthday, his discussion of solving the crises that are destroying civilization. So, Jason, thank you, and we'll be back with you next Saturday.
Thanks.